Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. I am your host, Logan Bartlett, and what you're going to hear on this episode is a conversation I have with Layla Sturdy. Layla is the managing partner at Capital G, which is Alphabet's growth investing arm. As managing partner, Layla acts as effectively the CEO of Capital G, which includes setting strategy as well as hiring and direction for the organization. Layla has invested in a number of iconic companies across both consumer and enterprise, including Duolingo and Whatnot in the consumer space, as well as Stripe, Gusto, and UiPath in the enterprise space. Layla and I talk about a bunch of different things that you aren't going to hear on any other show, including how Capital G makes their investment decisions, how she gets up to speed in different markets and is able to invest across both consumer and enterprise, what she thinks makes great founders as well as great investors, and her path into venture, immigrating from Jamaica to the United States when she was a kid. A really interesting conversation with someone that has become a friend and one of the few women leading investment firms and venture capital. And so I really appreciate Layla coming on and talking about the different strategies that she has seen within Capital G. And if you're enjoying content like this, please do like, share, subscribe on whatever platform that you're listening to it on. It really does help drive subscribers and continue to find new listeners that like this content similar to you. Without further ado, here's Layla.
Layla, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Logan.
I want to start. What is Capital G?
Capital G is a growth investment fund backed by Alphabet and Google. So our mandate is to invest in the world's greatest technology companies, partner with them to help them scale. So we typically invest Series B and up to pre-IPO.
What are you able to do differently, or what is different as having a single LP in Alphabet?
Lots of things. So first, what is similar to other venture funds is that we are an independent investment fund. So Alphabet's our single LP, but we invest for financial return, and our incentives are the same as sort of any other investment fund aligned with the portfolio companies. But since Alphabet is our single LP and they're a very long-term LP, they think about the long-term impact and potential of technology trends and are excited about the potential to build really big companies. So first, we have a very long-term orientation. Second is that we engage the employees inside of Alphabet and Google to help our portfolio companies. So over the last couple of years, we've had more than 3,000 Alphabet employees that have engaged with our portfolio companies on advisory relationships, anything from scaling cloud technologies to building out sales and marketing teams. So an example is CrowdStrike is one of our portfolio companies, and we helped incubate the inside sales team for CrowdStrike inside our offices. So we'll bring advisors on sales compensation, on lead gen and demand marketing. So all these very specific operating challenges that scaling companies face. We're able to find advisors inside of Alphabet to help the companies in very specific ways. And it's just a win-win for everybody because the Alphabet employees are excited about partnering with startups and helping use their expertise in new and innovative ways and learning. And our portfolio companies get access to really relevant, up-to-date learnings and expertise within kind of the Google and Alphabet family.
So how does it work? Do you say, like, is it actually a fund structure? I know that economics kind of work similar to that, but is it a fund structure? Or do you come and say, hey, here's about what we think we're going to invest over
It's a fund structure. So it would be set up just like Redpoint, but just as Alphabet as the single LP. So we look at it as sort of the best of both worlds. It's an independent fund structure where we where we're clear in our mandate, we have the sort of governance and fund set up, but where we have access to an LP that is a very long-term orientation, as well as this really unique network of advisors that can help our companies. And they also help us on the investing side in, we'll call in advisors on sort of emerging thesis areas, like AI is the obvious, very obvious
I've
and exciting one right now. You've heard about it. Yeah, I've probably had a few people on your podcast chatting about it. Obviously, within Google and Alphabet, we have, amazing experts in that area. And so we'll work with those leaders in technology to sort of bounce our ideas off of them and go back and forth. And that's been really an amazing asset, not just in AI, but in security, data, infrastructure, a lot of areas where we've made significant investments at Capital G. We've pulled in these advisors to help us pre-investment as well as post-investment.
Alphabet now is a $3.5 trillion. Excuse me, I'm used to billions in my vernacular. In your world, there's a T more often involved in that. A $1.5 trillion business. And are there three venture-ish private products? GV, Gradient, Capgemini?
Yeah, those are the three independent funds. Exactly.
Alphabet's so big, and there's a tension that exists between like the strategic nature of corporate VC, right? Which is, hey, we're doing this so we can get pure access, and we want to only invest in the themes that we care about as a parent company. Yeah. And then on the other side, it sounds like where you are is like the independence and the structure of a normal, quote unquote, venture fund, yeah. Which makes sense. It sounds like a lot of benefits for you going this way. What are the benefits for Alphabet going the other way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think, I mean, you have to sort of step back 50,000 feet, like as I think when Capital G was getting started, which is a little over 10 years ago. And really, actually, Larry and Sergey were quite involved in the early days of thinking about investment funds within Alphabet with GB, Capital G. And it really sort of mission and vision of, I think, Google and Alphabet overall, which is to help build transformative technology companies and obviously to innovate and to help be a catalyst and driver for some of the most important technology inventions and businesses in all of the different areas that Alphabet works and builds directly, as well as more broadly. So I think the vision was that the expertise of Google and Alphabet could really help build, influence, partner with, and create more innovation and help contribute to company building outside of Alphabet. And the reason we set, so it was, you know, with that vision, like, hey, the resources, the cash, the expertise of Google and Alphabet can help build amazing things inside of Alphabet and amazing things outside of Alphabet. And the reason we set up the fund structure independently as we have is because we believe that's the best incentive structure to recruit and help develop the world's best investors and the best for the companies. Because strategic investing is quite difficult to do, to have, you know, both financial metrics as well as strategic metrics
competing
that you're
masters,
competing.
Yeah.
It's very hard to do. And I think when you look historically, it's hard to point to strategic investment arms that have, you know, been the VC partners that have built iconic, you know, helped partner and invest in iconic companies repeatedly over time. So we really felt strongly that the best way to structure this, to build one of the world's best investment funds, was to have this independent structure and have the incentives right. And Alphabet, from the very beginning, has been super supportive of that. And that's why you see, in addition to other types of investing that they do within corp development or off the balance sheet, so there's lots of different ways, both strategic and sort of independent, that Alphabet's investing.
Other different types of investing. So you reference Series B-ish, yeah, through pre-IPO. I've seen your name pop up, mm-hmm, some recently in, yeah, some of the take privates as well. Duck Creek and Coupa,
yep,
I think, were the two most recent ones. How do you think about that in the suite of services or the types of investments you guys do?
Yeah. So I think our primary investing is in high growth pre-IPO companies. So if you look historically over the billions that we've invested, that is our sweet spot. So, you know, companies like Duolingo, CrowdStrike, UiPath, where we'll invest and partner in the Series B, and then ideally invest significantly more capital over the future rounds. And that's been primarily what we've done. We also are opportunistic and have sort of a broad mandate. And I think it's been a unique macro environment, to say the least.
We'll talk
and,
about that.
Yeah, exactly. And we have expertise within our team on evaluating, I think, everything from Series B to public companies. I mean, I'm still on two public boards. Like, we stay over, you know, quite a significant portion of the life cycle of companies, as well as private equity transactions. And so I think we've seen, we believe that Coupa, Duck Creek, some of these companies that you reference are high growth, high quality private technology companies, where many of these we've known for many years and looked at them over the course of their own growth life cycle. And we're excited to partner with, you know, those private equity firms to invest in those rounds as well. So I think we look at it as high growth, generational technology companies, we will invest. And that has primarily been in pre-IPO, but we also have invested in private equity transactions as well.
How much of that, you alluded to the macro thing, is it, I'm sure it's company specific in some ways as well. Coupa, obviously special business, Duck Creek, I've known for a long time. Actually, my old investment bank advised on the sale to Accenture, which is, I think, like six transactions ago at this point for Duck Creek.
Okay. Yeah,
so going way back.
Way
back to Duck Creek. So interesting companies. But did that start, and when you think about that, being that the private markets are kind of funky, I guess would be my generous interpretation of them over the last year. And so let's go look at the opportunistic things in the relationships we have, or was it more company specific? Like, we love these companies.
It's been company specific, and it's also been, we've actually done it since our inception at Capital G. So we have, for the last 10 years, a part of our fund has always been in these private equity transactions, because we look at it as a really good discipline, actually, as investors to be able to evaluate and think about the growth drivers of businesses of different size and scale. And certainly when you spend time, as we have over the last 10 years, looking at most private equity transactions are profitable companies because they're applying leverage, and you're talking a lot and thinking a lot about free cash flow. It turns out being able to evaluate and partner with companies at that scale is really helpful when you're on the board of a Series D company who you first invested when they were $15 million in ARR, and now they're several hundred, and in the point of their journey where they're gaining operating leverage and trying to get to profitability. So kind of understanding the trade-offs of that. As growth investors, we think it's actually good discipline and good training and expertise to be able to study companies at all those different scales. And just as long as they're growth companies, market leaders in big markets, we've been flexible about the type of transactions, and it's been from the beginning. So it even though in the macro environment, certainly there's been less growth deals overall, there's been these private equity deals since we started about 10 years ago.
Now, you, in March of this year, got appointed a new fancy title, which, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Managing partner, right? What does managing partner mean? It seemed like a big deal, and your longtime partner was stepping aside in that title. What responsibilities sort of roll up to you now, or how does
I don't know if it's fancy, but thank you,
it
Logan.
Fancy.
I appreciate it. Well,
I keep trying to appoint myself king internally, and people don't like that.
Has it flown?
No,
Keep trying. Keep them. Just travel with the mic around the whole thing. See how that works. No, I'm very excited. It's so the role is overall responsibility for running the fund. So I will continue to invest as a general partner, as I have for the last 10 years. And I love that part of my job. I love investing. I love serving on boards. And I'm also have taken on this increased responsibility of sort of overseeing the entire fund. So thinking, I'd say where I've spent even more time, even though I've spent a lot of time on this always over the years, is really thinking about recruiting and helping mentor and train our sort of next generation of partners at the fund, which for me is really rewarding. You know, I was an operator for a long time before I was an investor, and I've always loved hiring and thinking about team building and culture. And so I've been spending a lot of time thinking about that, investing in the team and the culture of the fund. And then some of the questions we've just been talking about, thinking about investment strategy and macro and how we think about, our deployment across different asset classes and all of that. So a lot of the same, and then some new fun additional responsibilities, I think, on the team and strategy side.
Now, investment decisioning, I've talked before about how we at RevPoint decide on stuff, but what has that evolved over time? How do you all make decisions today and come to an answer? Is it consensus? Is it one person pounding the table?
I would love to hear what you guys do at RevPoint. Yeah. I always find this an interesting question as well. So we historically have given general partners at the fund a lot of flexibility and empowerment to get deals done. And I think there's been a lot of trust across our partnership to for our general partners to kind of advocate for and take the risks that they seem appropriate. So we have a very rigorous investment committee process, and that's something that I think all of us love, because we I think we all have found that investing disproportionately in the investment committee makes us all better investors. So we provide a lot of detailed materials. We do a lot of sort of rigorous debate across, and we invite our entire team. So the general partners are the decision makers, but the whole team is invited to sort of see the dialogue. And I think we really pride ourselves on a strong pushback and engagement there. But we've done many deals that are not 100% consensus. So where there's been, certainly partners that have said, hey, I would not do that if I were you. I don't think this is the right call, but I'll support you doing it if you really advocate for that. So that's the approach that we've taken. And I think it's worked out really well. I mean, I think actually it's very fun to look back over 10 years and think about the deals that some of your partners who you deeply respect, wanted to lie on the tracks and prevent from getting done are heroic. And some you wish you listened to them.
Yes.
So, the humbling and heroic journey of investors.
At my prior firm, we went back and tried to analyze if any of the consensus or non-consensus led to any better decision, who was on the IC, and it was all noise. So we were able to figure it out. to answer your question, though, our early stage team operates more like you all do with a lot of autonomy, but a centralized IC process. So everyone gets to weigh in, but ultimately people are kind of trusted. Our growth team is much more consensus oriented. And I describe, I wish I came up with this because it's a great analogy, but my partner, Elliot, described it as like, so we have three general partners on the growth fund, and the way it tends to work is he compared it to a family trying to figure out what to watch on TV, which is like, if someone really wants to watch something and the other two are kind of want to watch it, you probably watch it, right?
Yeah.
If one person's like, over my dead body, are we watching that? Then you probably don't. If
so everyone, a lot of baking shows?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. If you end up in kind of a neutral space, then it probably doesn't. You probably keep looking. And we ultimately want someone in the group to feel uniquely passionate to drive to the decision on it, and then the other people along the way to feel passionate about it. It's something we debate, though. Ultimately, we have a lot of trust for one another. We've been in situations where we've been at loggerheads, but that it doesn't happen too frequently.
Yeah. No, it's super interesting. Yeah. Well, it would be good to go back and run that data comparatively over time.
So you alluded to this, but you had never invested before joining Capital G founding.
Yeah.
Were you
were
part of the original team?
I joined about 2 or 3 months after it was started.
Quasi-founder.
Yeah.
How did you learn how to invest and like what type of investor you were going to be? Because you always hear, oh, investing is an apprenticeship business.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the fun thing about investing, right, is that there's so many things to keep learning. And for me, it was in stages. So when I joined a little over 10 years ago, hadn't invested. The only thing I'd done is I worked at Bain before I was at Google, and we had a big private equity consulting practice there that I worked in, for a couple of years. And that was actually an amazing training where, I got exposure to the investment process and how diligence was done at big private equity firms.
Because at Pegg, you're working at Bain, but you're opposite a private equity firm, helping them in their diligence. And
exactly.
So ultimately the output is going to a private equity firm.
Exactly. And you basically learn the sort of methodologies of customer research, of market work, of kind of understanding, in these big private equity models, you're really validating assumptions like, okay, what's the market share gain going to be? How big is the market? Is it going to grow? What is the churn profile of customers look like? So you begin to understand sort of the mechanics of the analytical side of investing. And I liked that in sort of my early career, but I love technology. And so I was really interested. I wanted to be at a hyper growth company. And so I joined Google and spent many years on the operating side and love that. Never really thought that I would get into investing. I thought it would be an operator. I was considering various COO roles, actually, when I was considering leaving Google after many years. And that's when I got kind of recruited to Capital G and had the opportunity to think about venture and think about whether I'd like it, what I would have to learn, what if I'd be any good at it. And I think it was a gradual process of learning lots of different things. I think learning more of the investor toolkit, getting more familiar and getting more reps on the financial side of our business, building 5-year models, looking at data, figuring out which data to pay attention to, what's the noise. And that, I think, came from just reps. The more interesting and the more fun part, I think, came from the board work, was like really thinking about how great companies are built, how you think about building management teams, recruiting, making decisions on when you expand international, when you don't, like when, how does the data that you see in an investment diligence process show up in the boardroom in terms of kind of operational priorities? And I think that, I was lucky to have made, I think, some good early investments and to be in some boardrooms where I learned an incredible amount from the management teams. And I think a lot of my best investments actually came from learning in those board meetings and using those as sort of springboards to make other investments and to really know what to look for and the type of founders that I really wanted to partner with. I think it's both an apprenticeship business, and there's an element of learning as much as you can and putting yourself in as many sort of environments that have really steep learning curves as possible. And I think I was lucky to do that.
There's a funny thing. I too feel like I got lucky early on in my career with the companies I got to work with. And you don't get an opportunity to be lucky late in your career.
Yeah.
You have to be lucky early to be afforded, because otherwise—
Take it whenever you can get it.
The other way, it doesn't work quite as well. I think you end up fired
if it goes
the other way. What was the most, do you remember when you were coming in, like what was most surprising about investing just as an operator stepping into it? And you're like, this is confusing, because I've been a career sort of investor finance my entire life. And so this is all I've known. And so the weirdness of it, I try to think about what's weird versus a real business, quote unquote. But
so many things are weird when you're first coming in. So many things are different. Well, first of all, I think as an operator, especially, you know, I had worked in very early stage stuff at Google. So all of the things I was trying to get, I worked on YouTube monetization like after we bought YouTube. So in the early years, I worked on a bunch of new products around Google Maps and our payments business. And so it was a lot around launching early products for Google and helping them scale. And so I had very much of an optimist, entrepreneurial type approach to business building, which I think is wonderful in partnering with the entrepreneurs I partner with, because you have to be an optimist and believe this is going to work and be, you know, so enthusiastic about it. And I think the first thing that I had to learn was, I remember, for example, Stripe, I led that investment in 2016. I remember having many conversations with Patrick about all of the different products they were going to launch. And, you know, an operator's mindset, you're like, yeah, I'm going to launch them all. I'm going to launch them all next year. You know, you get in that enthusiasm. And of course, that works a lot of the time for amazing companies like Stripe. But I think the investor toolkit side, I really had to learn how to calibrate risk, how to think about both seeing the opportunities that entrepreneurs would paint, that you could see in the market, with, as a growth investor, being able to pattern recognize over time. So, you know, every CEO thinks they're going to grow net retention by X amount when they fix X, Y thing. But when you really look and say, okay, over a larger data set of companies, that would be more of an outlier expectation to see, you know, to see a variable like that change. So I just began to, I don't know if it's pessimism or reality, or learn to sort of combine the how to look about the data and how to think about risk reward, like both seeing the opportunity, because I think to be a great growth investor, you can never lose that like belief and to be able to tune into and lean into the right risks. But at least for me, over time, I learned to use the data to sort of calibrate which risks to take and when. So that was the biggest, I think, change, was to to marry maybe people like yourself that have been investors their whole career that had more of an analytical approach to it with more of a operator company building, like we're going to find a way to make this work and we're going to recruit the right people to do it. We're going to build the right teams to marry that with more of the analytical strategic decision making.
Now you've bounced around from an industry standpoint of what you focused on. So you Duolingo, you're still on the board of
still
public company,
of, yep.
Whatnot, super hot.
Yeah.
Fascinating business.
It's a great company. Yep.
Stripe, UiPath,
yep.
Gusto. These are a bunch of different types of businesses. How do you go about learning? Like one of the things I always fear is that I'm going to be the patsy at the table, that I don't know. I can't. How do you get your arms around the totality of what is to be known going into a new sector that maybe you haven't had previous experience in? How do you go about building domain in an area?
Yeah. So to me, that's been the most fun about being in investing for 10 years. It's like I couldn't imagine just staying in the same sector. Like for me, I love to take to explore areas where I know something and then I don't know something. So like have some sort of knowledge to get my foot in the door and then figure out how I can learn as quickly as possible. So it's been iterative. So when I first started investing, I had a lot of experience on the operator side with SMB businesses. So I'd helped launch a few different businesses at Google that sold into small and medium-sized businesses. So I understood how hard it was and is to sell into that customer base and how difficult it is to scale marketing, to set up sales channels. Like I had the sort of blood, sweat, and tears of understanding an experience on what I thought worked and what didn't. So, and then I had a lot of experience with consumer businesses on the Google side as well. So my first couple of years in investing, I really focused in that. So that's when I did Gusto, I did Duolingo. I did these businesses where I understood the small and medium-sized business value prop. I understood how to scale the sales channels. So to your point, I felt like I had some relevant expertise to be in the room. And then I would use it to sort of parlay into the next thing. So for example, one of the reasons I got really excited about Stripe was that they're competitive in the early days. They're competitive. One of their many competitive differentiation was just that they got these customers at inception and they had really figured out how to make small businesses easy to use, implement payments right away. And then these businesses grew into massive companies. So, they got the lifts of the world when they were just getting started. And then those grew into, massive compounding businesses. And so I really believed early on in what a differentiation that acquisition channel was, because I understood the hard part about scaling to small and medium-sized businesses. And then I said, okay, I'm just going to learn everything I can about the payments business. And, went studying and looked at every payments big platform that I could find and worked hard to kind of really understand the whole sector before I did that investment. And so it would kind of go like that. Like I used UiPath automation to parlay into a bunch of no-code investments because it was all going after similar thematic areas around digital transformation. So every couple of years, I sort of choose a new sector that I think is going to have a really strong impact across a bunch of different industries. And then we'll go deep in areas where I think there will be several investable opportunities and use what I learned to kind of to go into the next.
So how often will that start from a top-down thematic, like, hey, this is happening, the low-code world is coming to be, versus bottom up, hey, Stripe is a thing and it's working really well. I should go validate that this is the best of all the different things that exist around it. Is it some of both? How does it typically work?
So I think it's a bit of both. So I think at Capital G, it's certainly like across the board, all of the above. So I think we've made some great investments that have been in like established industries, like things like cybersecurity, where, there's some big disruption in some area of security that is going to, there's going to be a new cloud vendor that takes that market share. It's an existing market. And let's go evaluate the best next gen vendor and make that investment. So we've done a ton of those and I've done a few of those myself. But I think I love market creation opportunities as well. Like I love of really thinking about, and UiPath is a great example of that. That was not, hey, let's go find an RPA vendor or let's go find an automation vendor. That was, hey, we know there is this huge problem inside of companies of every size that the amount of software is proliferating across these companies. The applications don't speak to each other. There's a bunch of inefficiency that, knowledge workers have and how they move data across systems, how they get the job done. There has to be a better way to do this. Like, how do we solve systems talking to each other? How do we make knowledge workers more efficient? Because there's a shortage of coders, there's a shortage of analysts. More from the problem statement point of view, like talking to CIOs, talking to CEOs about like how are the ways that they can improve how their businesses run, and then thinking what are the technologies that can solve that. So I look at the automation investments and the no code investments as solving customer first and company first or world first problems and figuring out and seeing the sort of momentum that comes from that, very ROI based investments. So I've done both. Like I think, and I think across Capital G, we've done both as well. But I think you look for different things when you're thinking about what's a market creation investment and then what's a, hey, I'm really aware that there's some secular tailwind, like, you know, the cloud transition or something that's going to create a new winner in a big profit pool we know exists.
Is there a commonality across the companies you've invested in? You mentioned category creation as kind of an interesting one. If you were to draw a through line across the companies you've invested in, everything from you know, Whatnot and Duolingo to Stripe and Gusto and Webflow and all that, is the through line that you would draw, is it the category creation element? Is it the founder type that you gravitate to? Is it the size of the opportunity that you see? I'm sure there's multiple inputs.
Yeah, but certainly multiple inputs. But one thing that we haven't maybe talked about that I think is a through line in a lot of these companies is that first, it's the founder, for sure. It's for me, because I'm a very, like, I love people. I love partnering with founders and with companies. So all those companies that you just mentioned are people that I deeply admire, amazing entrepreneurs who I felt like I and Capital G could really be great partners for them. And they were also excited to partner with us. So, I mean, I've been on the Duolingo board, I think, for 9 years now. So these to me are like really long-term investments. So that is first and foremost. But the other thing that I think has stood out in almost all the investments I've made is that you look at there is something really compelling around the value to the customers or users that you can see in the data really early on. And that most commonly shows up in things like the cohort NDR, like compounding over time. I mean, look at companies like Stripe or Whatnot, and you just see they're totally different businesses. But what you can see is just an engagement in their core customers. You saw the same in UiPath, and it shows up in really high engagement data, really high revenue growth data on the enterprise side. And to me, that signal is just, this isn't just, oh, I bought a package of software and I kept it. This is, wow, this software or this new habit or service on the consumer side has really changed my life. And there is going to be a ton, from a business model perspective, a ton of future growth in existing customers that are going to. To me, those are the companies that have outlier growth, is where there's just a huge embedded potential in their existing customers to grow. And those are the ones that grow at disproportionately fast rates, that usually are in end markets that compound for much longer than you expect, and are, that from a business model perspective, get to profitability and hyper growth in a much more efficient way.
I hadn't thought of this before, but as you were kind of rattling off names, it also seems like you have a disproportionate number of immigrant founders.
Oh, interesting.
Have you ever thought of that?
Well, I'm an immigrant, so maybe I was born in Jamaica. So there you go.
I don't know.
I don't know. I never thought of it like that.
I don't know. A lot of those names.
Interesting.
How do you personally go about getting to a decision and underwriting your own investments? We talked a little bit about the CapG investment framework, but like at a personal level, how do you think about it?
This is one of the things that I do actually think, you're curious your thoughts too, that, you know, is an intangible thing about just being an investor, maybe being a good investor, is like, how do you get to the yes or no, after, especially growth stage investing, because you have so much data, you have so much that is exciting about the deal, and then there's always doubt. If nothing else, for the last several years, like, valuations have taken a lot of the fun out of the decision making process, because you have to believe so much is going to happen to make an attractive investment. So, I mean, for me, it ends up being intuition in that final stage. It ends up really developing conviction in myself on the most important things to pay attention to, because nothing is perfect. So, we take, examples like, UiPath, when I first did that investment in the Series B, it was those customer cohorts and the early customers that I spoke to with such enthusiasm around how the software and the platform was impacting their business and how excited they were to spend more. And that was so compelling that the company was growing so fast that there was lots of things that weren't working, right? When they'd grown from something, when I did the investment, I think it was like 7 to 35 million in ARR in that previous 12 months. And so you can imagine lots of things at every company like that are broken and concerning and could be flags, and you don't know how big the market is. And there's always conflicting data around how differentiated products and platforms are. So I find in making the final investment, a lot of the judgment comes back to quieting the noise around things that are less important than the most important thing. Mm. And so in that case, as an example, I really felt the most important thing was this enthusiasm that I was hearing from customers and the data around expansion, and knew that was a deal I wanted to get done. And every single other deal, there's something like that, where it really comes down to, you can talk yourself in circles about five or six things, but you have to ultimately say, this is the one or two things that I think really matters, and I'm gonna make the call.
This is what
I believe.
Yeah, I've got myself upside down. I thought I've evolved as anyone does as an investor, and where I've landed, and I think this will be consistent. Hopefully, this stands the test of time. But where I've landed is where I've struggled is when I've had false precision around what the exit could look like, and being like, oh, this is a 3 to 5x investment, right? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, we've seen multiples go so haywire over the course of the last 3 years that false precision was inaccurate no matter what. No matter what the assumption was, it was wrong in some way. And so where I've landed is, we'll underwrite investments to 3 to 5x with 10x plus upside. But where I've landed is, it, like, 10 needs to be a world in which I can believe, 20 or 30 or just something that is, the ball goes really, really far. And then also I sort of ask myself, do I really believe this is an important company?
Yeah.
And important is this very ethereal thing. What does that actually mean? What to important to who, whatever. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of the taste answer that I've landed on. And that could be, it's some elements of market and founder and customer feedback and all that stuff. But, like, do I think that there's a real shot when you walked in here, we have a bunch of the logos on our doors as we come in. And, like, do I think this company has a real shot at being one of those that we have hanging on for people to see when they walk through the door? And if not, then it's probably not the right investment. Mm-hmm. But it's taken me a little while to land there. And I had a lot of false precision along the way of what I thought multiples would be or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I think it's a really interesting place to land. And I mean, one thing that I was thinking about as you were saying that is just the 80-20 rule in life is forever humbling, I think, in terms of what you see. And I think you're right. I mean, one of the things that I've learned over time doing this the last 10 years is that you see how, companies like Stripe that we've been talking about, there's just how big and incredible some companies are, and the end markets that they're serving are, and you want to believe that more companies fit into that category. And I think when you look back historically, that that's not always the case.
Yeah. So power law and compounding are two like hard things to internalize. They're just not very natural for the brain to process. And then you see it all laid out and you're like, okay, I get it. But like how much value can be accumulated if something really works?
Yeah, completely. And keeping that bar really high when you're making a new investment, I think makes a lot of sense.
What about things that you haven't got there on? Not in any name specifically, but if you were to go back and say, hey, here are the commonalities of mistakes I made along the way that turned out to be really important businesses.
The biggest ones have been ones where we really did underestimated just how big the end market was. So what can go right? And it doesn't tend to be, I think what I've observed over time is that usually when you're wrong, the thing was already happening when you passed on the investment. So it was, hey, this company, we passed on price or something, to your point on too much precision, because it just didn't look like, even we knew it was a great company, it just didn't look like it was going to be an attractive investment because you had to assume so much growth to get a good return. And I think it was in underestimating how long those really big winners could compound for is always the hardest thing to get wrong. And I've seen that a few times. This is maybe where the entrepreneurial optimism comes in. The companies that come in and say, hey, this product's working, we're going to launch the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, most of the time that does not work as well as everyone hopes. Occasionally, we've been wrong on that, and I see that. And occasionally we've been right on that and made the bet. But I think it's harder to do second acts than it seems. But also wonderful things compound for for totally. Longer and bigger than you seem. And to your point, also, we've seen the upside and the downside of multiples on the exit path. So the bar that I bring to all our investments is this has got to be a business that you'd be excited to own for another 5 years after. And if you're not, it probably doesn't, if you're trying to time something, this is probably not the right thing to be doing.
We've referenced Duolingo. You've been on the board there for how long?
9 years.
There haven't been many independent standalone consumer businesses in the last decade that have gone public.
Yeah.
What have you learned about building an enduring consumer business from watching that one so closely for such a long time?
I mean, that has been one of the great joys of my life, to partner with Louise Fanon, who's the founder there, and that whole team. I've learned so much, and it's also
been very complimentary of you. I've seen some of the quotes in the press stuff. Yeah. But he attributes a lot of support and success to you as well. So.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. And it's, it's very mutual. It's been an amazing partnership, and I've learned so much from that team. And I think it really comes down to they have been incredibly mission focused and incredibly product and user focused from the very beginning. So they've been just relentless in their passion for and focus on teaching languages to anyone who wants to learn them around the globe, and to continue to really figure out how to make the product both fun and effective in doing that. So bringing this amazing mix of product experts, language learning experts, and then building this incredible innovation machine. So I think they got both the expertise around how to just intuitively having amazing product people, and then having the right expertise around teaching language, and then an incredible innovation machine on their speed of experimentation is like nothing I've seen in any other company. Like the number of A/B tests that they run in a given quarter, it like dwarfs the speed of innovation at most other companies. And that's just, to me, like what I love about what they've built is they have built both the A+ process around it, as well as the A+ like skill and expertise around it. So it's been as a result, they've and they're in a huge market, again, like billions and billions of people learning languages globally, and to build the world's best education platform to do that is just a massive opportunity. So I think it's the building blocks of what you'd say a great company has at a Series A, like great product people, great process, but just to see them relentlessly focused on that and be able to scale that as they added in new talent and expanded to a bunch of different languages and now expanded to a bunch of different education verticals. Always being on the cutting edge of technology as well. I mean, you look even to the latest, they were like one of the first consumer companies to come out with an AI-enabled product, you know, build off OpenAI. And so they're just, they're since day one to today, you know, the cutting edge of innovation. And then they have a great brand. Like, as you see, like they're very, they've been all in from an authenticity standpoint.
Great of, Twitter.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, I know. They rival you. Logan. Yeah, no, yeah.
I wish I could get to that level. Brand Twitter is a very hard thing to do. We've debated whether or not it's actually even really doable. There's like five examples of which Duolingo is one of doing brand Twitter well. It's hard. It's really hard to do.
It's really hard to do. I mean, I remember when I worked at YouTube way back in the day when, you know, companies would come in and say, how do you build a viral video? You know, and those type of things are really hard to explain. And to me, it comes from authenticity and genuine creativity and really understanding what your brand stands for and amazing people, which
I don't know if I made this up, but it's kind of my perception that you and Capital G like doing concentrated bets. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I would say, you know, our model is because we're very partnership driven. So we want to add a bunch of value to the companies and we're very thesis driven. So we like to make large bets. So, you know, we'll typically invest anywhere from 75 to multiple hundreds of millions in each of these companies do and partner over the long haul. So, so it ends up being reasonably concentrated portfolio, but we're also a fairly large fund at this point. So we're doing, you know, quite a few deals.
Does that go back to the compounding point and just like the power law that we were talking about? Is that most of the
Yeah, it's mostly we believe in the power law. We really want to be in the world's most consequential technology companies. We want to be able to partner deeply. And so we want to be able to spend the time and resources, bring these advisors that I spoke about at Google to our companies. I mean, an example of that is I think we've had, a couple of years ago when we like everyone, I guess, were realizing AI was going to have a major transformative effect on our existing portfolio companies as well as new ones being created. Google has an internal training that they offer to all of their engineers around AI. And so we started offering that same training to engineers in our portfolio companies. So we trained over 1,200 engineers within our portfolio on this Google specific AI training. So it's like examples like that where we really feel like we have value that we can add. And we're very thoughtful investors in terms of we do a lot of work before we make an investment. It aligns well to making big investments in individual companies.
What about talent development and people getting into the industry. So it seems like you all have followed some elements of your path that you've taken operators and trained them as investors, but also I think you have some career investors as well.
Yeah.
How do you think about developing talent within the venture ecosystem?
Yeah, I love this question because I really like think this is
part of your
secret sauce of like one of the things that Capital G has done well. And yeah,
and now it's a part of your new job.
Job is to think about team composition. And I think a secret sauce to building an incredible investment team is to really get a diversity of experiences in the room. So one of the greatest gifts to me when I started at Capital G 10 years ago was my partner, Gene France, who we joined Capital G about the same time. He's a couple months before me. And he had been a career investor. He worked at TPG for a long time, really an amazing investor. I mean, he's led CrowdStrike and Zscaler and so many of our incredible investments at Capital G. And we had totally different backgrounds. So I had, this operating background. He had this really extensive investing background, and we became very good friends and incredible partners to each other, and really complementary. And the type of questions I would ask an investment committee were very different from the type of questions he would ask. And I think we were able to offer perspectives to our portfolio companies that were complementary. And it really, you know, we've talked a lot about the external learning curve of an investor, how you learn, you know, being on the boards of these companies and through your mistakes and through your successes. And I think having a diverse team inside the firm just accelerates that learning curve so much more. So I felt it directly as I was learning how to operate in this world. And I think and I see it now within our sort of next generation of investors at Capital G. We've tried to build a similar mix. We have, you know, a partner on our team, Jill Chase, who is a CEO of a company prior to coming to investing. It had never invested before Capital G. And then we have other partners that have only grown up at H&F and Advent and other really, really great investment firms. And you see it. You see it in the halls, them learning from each other, them seeing the complementary things that each other bring. And I don't know, I think it's there's no better way to build a team than to bring as many relevant experiences as you can in the door and build a collaborative culture where there's people help from each other. Otherwise, it's just, you know, more of the same, and then you can operate in that lane. But I don't know, it eliminates a lot of possibilities. So I believe in it. And I also think, you know, from a mission perspective, thinking about bringing in the diversity of experiences also opens the door to bringing in more diverse people, which is also good for the industry, good for company building, and like
because
good
you're
for
not
the
beholden
world.
To investment banking classes.
Exactly, or investment banking classes who tend to look more similar and from more similar backgrounds. And as you open up the aperture to what type of talent you're looking for, you can also bring in not just diverse expertise, but diversity in other ways. So there's a bunch of, I think, great reasons to do it. And it's something, as you can tell, I care a lot about. And I think I'm proud of what we're doing at Capital G in that regard.
What advice do you have for young folks that want to get into the industry? I struggle with this at times because people will ask, well, can you talk to me about your path? And I'm like, sure, yeah, I can. But like, that's not particularly relevant today. That worked 10 years ago, right? And so thinking about what actual advice to give to maybe it's someone in banking or at a company that wants to get into the industry, or a junior person at a venture fund today. Do you have advice?
I get asked this question a lot too. And I think it is a hard question, but I will tell you, to me, one of the things that I think people don't always appreciate about investing, and I don't know what you think on this, Logan, but there's an element that you have to be scrappier and a lot more of a hustler than I think people realize. Like, you have to find ways to get yourself in rooms that you weren't invited to up front. You have to think of more thoughtful and more creative things to ask entrepreneurs and ways to add value, especially at the growth stage, where these are companies that have a lot of choices. The very best companies in the world have a lot of choices on who they bring on as an investing partner. So it takes effort and to think about how you can truly be a relevant partner to them and how you can even get a conversation with them. So I like to, first of all, tell people that, because a lot of people, I think that maybe investing is a little bit more glamorous than it is from the outside. And so the advice I also give to people is demonstrate that. Show how you're getting in rooms, whether you're angel investing or advising or even demonstrating, how do you uniquely figure out, and you can tell even how someone gets to you. Like, I'm sure you probably, Logan, get asked a bunch of, for your time on this topic, like, how did they get to you, and how valuable did they make that meeting for you, and what sort of insightful or creative things do they bring? And so a lot of the off the beaten track or maybe less traditional path investors that we've hired, how they got to me and how they showed up in that first meeting, or how I saw them get to entrepreneurs, or how they showed up in that first deal, like, you can tell. You can tell, I think, who's got some of that,
totally.
That special sauce.
It's a, yeah, it's a great call out. The one that I'll typically give, I think the grit thing is really important. There were definitely points in time that a handful of CEOs probably wanted to issue restraining orders on me for my level of persistence.
I've heard that, actually.
Yeah. There is that one that actually did.
Yeah.
No, but so I do think the grit element of all of that is a super important one. And then also I found if you could pick something that you think will be more, if you're a junior within a firm or trying to join a firm, picking something that you think will be more important in the future than it is today.
Totally.
And building some level of domain expertise in that. Totally. And it could be selling to developers, right? Or it could be at-risk healthcare businesses, or it could be whatever it is. Pick something that you think is in the path of progress and run to that point in time. And I found people too often pick what's hot today, and then you're already late. Like if everyone's already doing it, if it's AI, then you're behind the curve and everyone else wants to do it. And so how are you going to stand out? So pick that one domain that you're going to uniquely know well. And then at some point, if you're right, then someone will want that skill set or that knowledge within the industry. And you obviously need to grind to get to people. Yeah. I found people are less persistent than they should be. Like the number of, I guess I shouldn't say this, but I have ignored emails that if they don't put in any level of like personalization and what it's just I'm not you know you get a lot of emails right and it's like
Completely.
But if you put in thought
Logan, you're gonna get the most personalized emails coming out of
I'm
this
setting myself up for honestly my weakness and
generative AI target
all people need to
Logan
do is just be
Red
like
Point.
I'm such a simple outbound just say you like the podcast and then it's like that's it. I'm like yeah how much time do you have let's
exactly.
go on a walk together are you
free all day Sunday
yeah Are you free on Sunday? I'll block my afternoon. We can talk about the podcast. No, but there is something to that of like just personalizing the thoughtfulness of it, right? And it's amazing how low clearing the bar can be if you just put in a little bit more time and thought to it.
I completely agree with that. The other thing I think that's really interesting about what you said and I agree with is like, I think another thing that's underappreciated about investing is that you do have to make a call. So you have to making that call, or I'm going to, you know, become an expert in targeting developers, to your example, or at-risk healthcare. It's you have to sort of put a stake in the ground before it is consensus obvious, I think, both internally and externally to be there when the puck gets there. And you're right some of the time and you're wrong some of the time. But I see people that get frozen by their they you know almost analysis paralysis.
Yeah, the
have
paradox
to make
of choice.
Sure, they're right.
Yeah,
and that also does not scale once you get inside the investment firm because you have to operate with a lot more uncertainty to get things done.
Now, perspective on the venture industry today.
Ah, yes.
It's weird. It's a weird market we live in.
Yeah. I mean,
so you joined the industry
2013.
Okay, so we're about the same. I was 2014.
Yeah.
I feel like I've learned.
Remember those good old days?
Yeah. Everyone, I will say the totality of the time, everyone always says, this is so expensive.
Yeah.
I think the last 2 years, or 2021 specifically, it was so expensive. I think time has proven that. I also think I've learned maybe more in the last 2.5 or as much as I did in the first 6 or 7 in the industry. What's your perspective on the state of play as we sit here in July of 2023?
Yeah, so I agree. I mean, radically different last 2 years than the kind of 8 years before that. I think I have the lucky position, I guess, of being on a couple public boards and then all these private boards. So it's been interesting to just see the public companies are like way past this. They've like sort of moved on, right? There was a correction to valuation multiples. There were some operating changes that had to happen. There was sort of an acceptance of reality, and then they've moved on. It's interesting to juxtapose that with a lot of the private companies who I think have been more in a more almost frozen state for a while. They've obviously had to make a lot of operating changes because there's, been some degree in slowdown in businesses, depends on the individual one. And then there's been this macro push towards profitability and shift away from the growth of it all cost mentality. So entrepreneurs have had to make hard operating decisions, and those, I think, a lot of restructurings that have been difficult and painful, and I think a lot of changes inside the company. But from an external capital perspective, a lot of it has been largely frozen. So I think what that means for you and I, when I think of the sort of deal flow in traditional growth, Series B to D, I mean, it's just radically down, right? Like from a volume and dollars perspective. And most of those companies are staying at their 2021 valuations and their hearts and minds, yeah, if not reality. And many of the best ones have like significant amount of cash that they might not have to raise for many years. So I think what that's meant for growth stage investors, I mean, for us, we've done a lot of existing, of investing within our existing portfolio. So companies we know really well that wanted more capital for various reasons. There have been some growth deals that have done, and we've been investing. And I think, as we talked about before, there's been some more interesting private equity type deals that we've done. And but overall, if you said state of the industry, it is slower, and there's still a disconnect between public market valuations and private market valuations. There's still companies that have a significant amount of cash. I'm seeing the most interesting things actually in the sort of pre-IPO pipeline are those companies. And there's starting to be excitement heating back up. That's quite recent. I think the last couple of months of people thinking, hey, maybe the IPO window might open up. And you see those companies, at least the CEOs I talk to, are closer to the public market companies on just wanting to accept reality. They're like, this is what my valuation is. Let's just...
We can comp it very clearly against some other business. It's not in the jar over here that says 2021 on it.
We don't care what happened in 2021. Like, they see the amazing companies that are public that have been corrected. They just want to, move on with it. And they know they have. If you're in a lot of the companies that are really in the IPO pipeline are great businesses. They have confidence in their business and their business model. And they just, they know the next step is just to understand their public market evaluation. So I see those starting to heat up, and we'll see in terms of like maybe, there's some secondary transactions that are starting to happen, I think, more in those companies. And if the IPO window doesn't open up, I would imagine that some of those companies will do additional private raises. So that's, some of the trends. So we've still been very active. I think we're excited that, and I'm curious your perspective, but as we look into 2024 and we look at, our analyses on a lot of these companies, many more will need to start raising. And so we think volume is going to pick back up pretty considerably going into next year. And we're starting to see it.
That was our prognosis. We sort of felt like Q3, Q4, but in particular Q1, Q2, if you just sort of look at some swags on estimated burn rates and cash out and when people are going to need to go back and test the market and take their medicine or not. My one piece of advice for all companies is like, don't assume what you think your valuation should be based on your prior round or some other comp in the market. Let the market dictate it. Because I think I've had conversations where founders have said, yeah, we're looking for X on our multiple of our last round. And it's a weirdly easy disqualification. It's both the valuation, you might not hit it, but two, the psychology of the founder, that if they're still so focused on like, oh, we want a 2X our last valuation when we're in this super upside down world, it just kind of shows that they don't quite get it, right? And so if there's some lesson I would give to any founder listening to this that's going to go raise in the next 12 months, just like don't take what the market says. Say you're going to let the market speak for itself, and then you'll get options on there, because you might be wrong to the upside and you might be wrong to the downside. But getting people to do work is the hardest thing to do. Make them, because we only have so many cycles that we can really dig into. And if if you're giving them a reason to disqualify it from the start, that's probably not the best way to go raise capital. So
no, I mean, I agree with the general sentiment for everybody, for investors, for entrepreneurs. Like, it's just accepting reality when there's big changes, I think, is the most, it can be a difficult process. And I think, in my experience, dragging that out for longer does more pain than good. So I agree. Like, I think the best thing that any, I think, founder can do is find amazing capital partners that believe in the long-term vision and bring them on at a fair price, and then get on with growing the business. So I think that stands the test of time over every macro cycle.
Now, I have to ask about artificial intelligence. What's your perspective on the industry or the opportunity there?
Yeah, so I think probably like everybody, I'm very excited about every day. It really is. And at Google, we get some internal like looks even at some of the pre-launch stuff, and it is truly incredible, especially this generative AI stuff more recently, like the potential use cases that are really disruptive and value creating in the way that we work, in the way that we consume content. And so I'm excited about those, the potential for that. I think that existing technology companies that have users, that have distribution, that have infrastructure, that are leaning forward on adopting this technology are incredibly well positioned. So when I put my investor hat on, I think I mentioned Duolingo. I think of the companies like Duolingo, UiPath that are so well positioned to adopt because they're still cutting edge. They still have great technologists. They're innovative. They can move quickly. So the biggest question I have is, I'm 100% sold on how big and transformative this long-term trend is going to be. And I think we're in the early innings of seeing where the value accrues. And I think value can accrue to existing, fast-moving, innovative companies, and value will accrue to new startups. It's been, we've made a handful, not all of them are announced AI investments. And I think we've gone earlier than we have traditionally because we're so excited about the trend. I think the growth stage, because of the cost, especially of large language models, is so prohibitively expensive at this point that it's the valuations of those rounds have been confusing, to say the least.
Struggled as well.
Yeah. So I think it hasn't been... We're still in such early innings that, to me, where I'm focusing my team, and we're spending a lot of time trying to get as smart as we can, make bets where we can, and really look at this as a long-term play, encourage our existing portfolios to be early adopters of, and be leaders in the market around AI applications. And then I think the investments will come. But it certainly for growth stage investors, we're in the early innings.
Is that the sector you mentioned every 18 to 24 months kind of repotting the sectors you spend in? Is that the one that you're spending the
I've
most
been spending
time in?
A lot of time. Yeah. It's also a great time to spend a lot of time in this sector because I think it's we have a great expertise within Google Advisors to help us, and this is going to be something we all have to understand deeply as we go for the rest of the time that you and I will be investing, Logan.
Yes.
I think this it will be a good use of time.
Now, I want to end on the personal side here. So you were born, we alluded to this before, you were born in Jamaica, but grew up in Florida.
I was the original, the OG Florida tech scene.
Totally, 100%, a one-person tech scene.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
There. Wait, so can you take me through? It seems like you had an unusual, you studied biochemical sciences.
Yeah.
You went to Kenya.
Yeah, so what was you've done a good podcast research, Logan.
It's what I do. If there's anything I do, is my homework on this stuff. Can you just, from a storytelling standpoint, how'd you go from Jamaica? Why were you in Jamaica? How'd you end up in Florida?
Yeah.
Maybe take us all the way through.
How long do you got here?
We can lay flat on that couch.
Exactly. Session. I'll try to make it as brief as possible.
Yeah.
I'm not sure your listeners will be as interested, but I appreciate the question.
I don't know. It's an interesting, I don't know how many Jamaican born VCs
there are. There you go. I'm not sure about that either. My parents met on a beach in Jamaica. My dad's Jamaican. My mom's from England. And I was born in Jamaica. And then my parents immigrated to Miami when I was a young kid. So I did all my schooling in public school in Broward County, South Florida. I went to Harvard. I played basketball. So basketball was my first love. So I grew up playing basketball and I played college basketball at Harvard. And I think because I had immigrant parents, I always had a very global outlook to the world. So when I was graduating college, I wanted to live and work overseas. So I lived in Ireland, in Dublin. I lived in Kenya for a short period of time. I worked for an education nonprofit there. So I, in addition to caring a lot about entrepreneurship and technology and business creation, I care a lot about social justice issues and education, global education. So I worked on a number of organizations that were working in various aspects of human rights and education. And then eventually came back and went to business school and got more involved in the tech sector after that. Hmm. The abridged version.
Are there elements of either basketball or Kenya or Ireland?
Yeah.
What lessons did you internalize that maybe you're most
invest in Irish entrepreneurs?
Yeah, that's a good one, honestly.
This stripe. I don't think I knew that when I was living in Dublin. I mean, I think what I think was similar about my kind of early career and how I approach investing. First of all, I love new things. Like I've always moved to countries and took new jobs where I was challenged and could learn a lot. And the challenge was even sort of getting in the door and learning something new. And also a very global outlook. So I think that, we talk about themes across my investments, but I think when you look at Duolingo or UiPath is another good example. I mean, one of the secret sauces of UiPath, Romanian founder, and Daniel was so focused on the global markets from the beginning and had offices and customers in international markets way before the typical US-based software company would. So I think that type of global outlook and non-traditional thinking and maybe a little bit of, outsider thinking, I think has been, it tends to be the people that I gravitate towards. And I think, you talked about grit and sort of resilience and creativity, and I think a lot of those elements are the people I've been attracted to in entrepreneurs and business building, and that I've been attracted to in kind of all aspects of in my life, before and after tech.
Well, good. Well, thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.